And now for something a little less practical, it would seem. English. It ranks 6th on the list of most popular college degrees, according to the Princeton Review. As part of our series on new college graduates looking for work, reporter Monica Brady Meyeroff, a member station WBUR in Boston, met an English major who was asking herself how much her degree is worth.
Heather LaFave's devotion to writing began at an early age.
Even before I knew how to write, I would just play with action figures and make up stories that way. Not just simple ones, like really elaborate ones, like soap opera stories.
Heather went to Brandeis University in Waltham, just outside Boston, because she wanted to double major in English and creative writing. She graduated summa cum laude. Her thesis earned the highest honors, and a short story of hers won a writing award.
It sounds silly and embarrassing. It was about a zombie. He just wants to make his way in the world like everyone else, but life is difficult for him because of who he is.
Heather, while drawn to writing about zombies, is normal-looking, tall with chin-length light brown hair. A few days before graduation, she gets together with a group of close friends.
She and I were roommates.
We were roommates freshman year and sophomore year.
They are humanities majors and nervous about their futures, says Ray Smith.
Obviously nervous. That's it, sorry, just nervous.
They're having a movie marathon of their favorite childhood films, a send-off to their youth. They crowd around a laptop on the floor of a messy dorm room because no one owns a TV.
It is 4 years since our departure from NIM, and our world is changing.
Those words from the 1982 movie The Secret of NIM could also sum up where these students are at, facing an uncertain future. But they aren't together to worry about that right now. Their next movie will be Heather LaFave's choice.
I still love Jasmine.
Aladdin, a lighter movie. Heather says she used to want to be an actress, but her mother told her she needed a backup plan and suggested she become a writer. Now Heather says her goal in life is to write stories for people to enjoy. But she's unsure of how to reach that goal, so she's turned to what she considers a practical solution.
I'm trying to get a job in publishing. Frankly, I'll take what I can get right now. I've also signed up for some temp agencies because right now I need money.
She needs money to start paying off $85,000 in student loans. And to do that quickly, she has questioned whether an English major was such a great choice.
For a lot of this year, for a lot of senior year, I would worry about, like, not only do I have a degree that stereotypically doesn't help anyone, but also the economy is in shambles.
Heather turns her head to the side, as if considering the other options.
But then I think, well, I mean, with that major, does the economy make that much of a difference?
She's not sure yet, but she does know her studies in English helped her to be analytical, and she says she has a trump card.
Ultimately, though, I can write. I'm a good writer, like not necessarily just fiction, but essays and memos, and not that I really need to write memos, but I'm good at getting across what I need to say in words, in writing, and that's a skill that will stay with me, regardless what I end up doing.
For now, Heather LaFave has moved in with her parents in Derry, New Hampshire, and is trying to get back her old high school job as a cashier. For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady Meyeroff in Boston.
Our series continues tomorrow when we meet a graduate from Montana who's working in a home improvement store while he figures out what to do with his degree in television production.
I'm only getting 30 hours a week, and my boss has told me that's all he can give me right now because things are tough, and I'm lucky to have that. So what do I do now, you know? What do I do now? I just really don't know.
That's tomorrow on our series, Setting Out, here on Morning Edition.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Don Ariely parses the irrationality of human decision-making. He is a behavioral economist. In his latest book, he sums up his view of humankind this way. Far from being the Mr. Spock-like rational creatures of classical economics, we have a lot more in common with another TV icon, Homer Simpson. But while in the past, Professor Ariely has shown how our irrationality makes us such likely suckers, this time, in his book, The Upside of Irrationality, he seems to be warming to us human nutjobs, and he joins us now from New York. Welcome to the program once again.
Nice to be here again.
And I'd like you to focus in this conversation on what we work for and how, through the lens of behavioral economics and psychology, you see compensation as something more complicated than it might appear to an academic economist.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting that when you ask people what is the relationship between the size of bonus that we give somebody and their motivation to work and their performance, people think that both of these relationships are positive. You give people higher bonuses, you promise them higher bonuses, they will try harder, and then they'll actually become more successful. They'll produce further. And of course, the recent financial recession should get us to pause a little bit and think, is this really the case? Now, it's actually very hard to test. So we try to create an experiment, because in real life, you can't examine this to the same degree.
You mean actually seeing whether bonuses make people work better or not?
That's right. So imagine the following experiment with three conditions. Condition one, we give you six tasks. Each of them lasts a few minutes. In total, they last about an hour. And I say, Robert, if you do very well on all of these six tasks, I'll give you one day of compensation, whatever you make in a regular day. Mm-hmm. If you do half of them well, I'll give you half a day compensation, a third, and so on. In another condition, I say, if you do those well, I'll give you 2 weeks of compensation. Mm-hmm. And in a third condition, I say, if you do those six things well, I'll give you 5 months of compensation. Now we're talking real money.
Right.
And the question is, what would happen to your desire to succeed and what will happen to your actual ability to succeed? And it's not a big secret to think that the more money I promise you, the more you will try. But the question is, will you succeed?
Now, we have to say here that to actually conduct this experiment, to say, to come even to NPR, needless to say, not to Wall Street, you could run into some money offering people, you know, several months' compensation.
That's right. NPR is easier than Wall Street, but we actually created the experiment in India. And what happened? What happened is that despite the fact that people want to succeed more when they get a 5 month salary, they actually succeeded to a much lower degree. In fact, there was one task in which about 43% of the people got it right when we got them the low level of bonus, but at the high level of bonus, only 4% got it right.
And the tasks were no more difficult at the higher level of bonus?
No, they were exactly the same. They were exactly the same task. So everybody did the same task. And the way to think about it is, imagine I told you that if you will be really fun in the next 10 minutes, I'll give you $100,000.
Yeah, I'm prepared to choke right now at that offer.
That's exactly what happened. So it turns out that money is kind of a two-edged sword. It's a motivator. When we get more money, we want to do better. But it's also a stressor, in the sense that the more money creates more stress. Now, in simple task, if I told you I'll pay you to jump, and I gave you either $1 per jump or $1,000 per jump, you will jump more because you have good control over your muscles and you can just will yourself into higher effort. But when it comes to creativity and problem solving and thinking and memory and concentration, it turns out you can't will yourself to higher level of performance. And instead, the high bonus actually got people to be very stressed.
But if I were a Wall Street banker, I can imagine a Wall Street banker saying, you don't understand, we have a different relationship to stress. We thrive off of people who thrive on stress, are totally stressful. We don't care when they have cardiac arrest, but they make a ton for us while they're working.
Yeah, so, you know, I went to give a talk to some bankers, and they said exactly that, right? They said, oh, no, you do experiments on regular little people, and we are super special people.
Right.
We thrive on stress to such a degree that there's not enough money in the world that would get us to stress. We would never get to that level. And I'm an experimentalist, right? And I proposed to them that they'll give us enough research budget and come to the lab and we can test them out. But they were not that interested.
Okay. Now, I want you to tell us about another experiment that you did and that you write about in The Upside of Irrationality, which also gets to the nature of work. This was inspired by friends of yours who had the experience of either preparing a very big PowerPoint presentation or editing a book, some project that is then canceled. You do the work, you get paid for it, perhaps quite well, but nobody actually sees the thing that you've done.
That's right. So the question is, why do we work? And of course, it's much more complex than this one simple answer, but one trivial answer that people often give is we work for money. And it turns out that basically works for rats under some conditions, but people work for many more motives, including meaning, a sense of completion, and so on. But in our reasoning about why people work, we often don't include that part. And because of that, we created an experiment. We basically created two simple conditions. In the first condition, people came and we said, we are going to give you Lego robots and you're going to build them and we'll pay you in a diminishing scale. $3 for the first, $2.70 for the next, and so on. And every time you finish one, we'll ask you, do you want to build another one? And they will say yes or no, and we'll see when you stop.
With Legos, this is?
With Legos, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the question is, when is the benefit of building a Lego not sufficient, and you decide to stop? And after people finished each piece, we put it under the table, and we said, do you want another one? This was the first condition, which we call the meaningful condition. In the second condition, which we call the Sisyphic condition, we gave them a Lego robot, and if they said they want to build another one, we gave them a new one, but we took the first one they just built and unassembled it in front of their eyes. And if they said they wanted to build another one, we gave them the first one they built and we took apart to build again. And we basically did the merry-go-round of these two robots, back and forth, until they decided they didn't want to do it. And there were basically two results. In the condition when we took it to pieces in front of their eyes, people stopped much faster. They basically did not enjoy the task as much. The second thing is that we asked people how much you enjoy Legos in general. And what we found was in the meaningful condition, when we didn't assemble it in front of their eyes, the more they liked Legos, the more they persisted in the task. But in the second condition, there was basically no correlation. And I think it's basically because of the simple fact that by destroying people's labor in front of their eyes, we kind of erased every possible meaning out of it. We kind of choked the joy out of this task, and therefore they just gave up much faster, and they were just not interested in this. And sadly, I think that this is a good analogy for lots of stuff that we do in the workplace, when we take things that could have been enjoyable, and by doing little things to people's ability to infer meaning on their job, we just kind of eliminate motivation and joy.
Don Ariely, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, as always.
Don Ariely, who is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, is the author of The Upside of Irrationality.
This is NPR. To talk to us about what the oil spill may mean for the future of BP, one of the world's largest oil companies, we're joined by Holly Pattenden. She's head of oil and gas for the risk analysis firm Business Monitor International, and she joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with what this is going to cost BP.
Well, considering the combined amount of claims that BP is going to have to pay out, estimates range from around $12 to $20 billion in terms of the total cleanup costs and compensation claims that BP will have to pay. When you look at the amount of value that's actually been wiped off BP's share prices, though, that's closer to $50 billion. So we can see that the market has overreacted in terms of the value that's been lost from BP compared with its liability.
$20 billion or anything even in that neighborhood, huge amount of money. But is it going to be enough to cover the damages? I mean, I'm thinking here about legal costs, things that aren't even can't even be tallied up quite at the moment.
Yeah, well, there are going to be huge numbers of unforeseen costs. This is the working on the estimates at the moment in terms of all the compensation claims that they're expecting to receive from fishermen for loss of earnings and from other industries around the Louisiana area. So they're estimating that that's what it's going to cost them. But if you compare that with BP's quarterly profits of about $6 billion, at the most, it's going to cost them about a year's worth of profits.
What kind of effect might this spill have on regulations here in the U.S.?
Well, the first thing that we've seen is Obama getting rid of any plans to open up more federal waters to offshore drilling. They're going to have much stricter regulations offshore. I think the use of what are called acoustic sensors is probably going to be mandated, as it is currently in deep water operations in Brazil and Norway. We're also going to see insurance costs rise a lot. Most of the companies doing these kind of operations have to do self-insurance anyway, because the external insurers won't take the risk on board. So we're going to see the cost of self-insurance rising an awful lot. And in general, we're going to see the costs of exploring and operating offshore increase to a great degree.
Let me put this in some perspective here. It's now the biggest oil spill in U.S. history, and if it isn't fixed until August, which is possible, it would pour out, by estimates, several million barrels of oil before it's finished. How does that compare with spills in other parts of the world?
Well, the worst spill ever in history was after the Gulf War in 1991, when the retreating Iraqi army deliberately sabotaged a number of oil wells in the Gulf. That resulted in a spill of around 11 million barrels. The second worst oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was the Ixtoc well in the Mexican area of the Gulf, which spilt about 3.5 million barrels. So we could well see the Macondo disaster, if it carries on till August, vying up there, unlikely to get to 11 million barrels, but becoming the second worst oil spill in history, and certainly the worst accidental oil spill in history.
And does it make a difference that it's there in the Gulf, you know, with a certain kind of ecology that it has?
Yes, I think the main problem in Louisiana is that the coastline is a very sensitive ecosystem of mangrove swamps, and unlike on a rocky shoreline, for example, in Alaska, where the Exxon Valdez disaster happened, there the shoreline can be cleaned relatively quickly by the action of the waves and by the ease by which the oil can be sent back out to sea and diluted. In the mangrove swamps of Louisiana, that oil is going to circulate within internal currents within that system, and its presence will still probably be felt in decades to come.
And the time we've been talking about this spill, it's being considered the deepest spill ever. But how many other oil wells are out there that are this deep?
In terms of more than 5,000 feet deep, there are 33 deep water rigs at the moment in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, which are drilling at that kind of depth. All of those have been ordered to cease drilling by President Obama while they re-examine the safety features on board each of those rigs and in the seabed as well. So that's about the level of rigs that are out there drilling that deep.
Is that what's happening right now then, that other oil companies are now in fact re-examining their deep wells?
Absolutely, yes. They've been ordered to cease drilling in order to make sure that this kind of accident can't happen on any of the other rigs that are drilling at this kind of depth, and in order to test all the safety equipment that's already in place, which is designed to stop this kind of blowout occurring.
Thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Holly Pattenden heads the oil and gas division for the risk analysis firm Business Monitor International. She was speaking to us from London. It is graduation time, and at a high school outside Portland, Oregon, students are combining final exams with putting the finishing touches on a new house. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
At Forest Grove High School, the sports teams are called the Vikings, and every year some students build what they call a Viking house in the surrounding neighborhood. It's a real house that the school sells to raise money.
We're out here sweating. Most kids are sitting in classes.
Valerie Bongiorno is a senior who plays on the basketball team. She's in the backyard building a shed.
When we put the roof on, we were swinging from the trusses like little monkeys. This isn't even like really a class. Like, yeah, we do. We learn more than any other class in the school, but it's more like a job, like, I guess.
One of the woodshop teachers, Chris Higginbotham, designs the house every year. This one has skylights, an inlaid wood floor, handmade maple cabinets in the kitchen. Local contractors volunteer to help out the kids, so everything ends up looking high-end and professional.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah, we try to put those little touches in the house and just try to add a little bit more wood into the house than you see these days.
Higginbotham says this is his dream job. He used to work for a home builder, but he likes teaching these high school kids.
I had a couple young ladies in 2008 that were both valedictorians, involved in everything, plays, sports, you name it. And they said, what was your most valuable high school experience? And without a doubt, they didn't even hesitate. Viking house, Viking house.
During the boom, these houses were selling for around $400,000 every year. Given the market right now, though, they'll be offering this house for around $315,000. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen says BP has started sawing through the bent pipe now sitting atop its gushing well in the Gulf of Mexico. That is a key step in the latest effort to capture oil and gas spewing from the well, as plugging it from above is now considered too risky. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Before BP tried its top-kill maneuver last week, it had a list of other things it could try to plug the well if that didn't work. For example, they had another blowout preventer they could put on top of the broken one, or a valve they could install there. But today, Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen made it clear those ideas are now off the table.
I think the first thing to understand is we're not talking about capping the well anymore. We're talking about containing the well.
That is, capturing the oil and gas that comes out of the well and piping it to the surface. Capping the well from above is just too risky. It turns out the well pipe under the seabed is possibly in much worse shape than they'd realized before they tried the top kill maneuver.
We don't want to restrict the flow and put pressure down that well bore because I don't think we know the condition of it, given the results of the top kill data that we got back.
Plugging the well at the top could end up forcing oil and gas out the sides of the well and into the ocean, and that would be much harder to deal with than a gushing pipe. So the plan is to capture the oil from the pipe. To do that, they're first going to chop off the bent pipe at the top of the well coming out of the blowout preventer. That will actually increase the flow of oil. BP says by 10%, Allen says quite possibly by more.
We could see during that period before the cap goes on a 20% increase in oil flow. And we have discussed with British Petroleum mitigating measures regarding undersea dispersant use and so forth as we move forward to try and mitigate the impacts.
That could spew for 24 to 36 hours or longer. But at some point, BP plans to lower a gadget over the freshly cut pipe to capture the flow and convey it to the surface. Allen says they have two connecting devices to choose from, depending upon how clean the pipe cut turns out to be. One has a rubber seal, the other one would have a loose fit.
I don't want to trivialize this, but it's kind of like the difference between having a garden hose with a rubber gasket in it or not.
The well will flow until at least August, which is when BP hopes to pump cement into the bottom of it from a second well. As a result, BP is now working on a plan so their oil capture system will work regardless of the weather. And that could be a challenge. Hurricane season started today. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It may be risky giving your novel the same name as a successful TV series, but author Alice Lichtenstein did just that. The book is called Lost, and that's where the similarities end. Alan Chews has our review.
Lost dramatizes the struggle by a scientist named Susan Hunsinger to keep her marriage together as her architect husband Christopher sinks deeper and deeper into Alzheimer's dementia. The novel takes place over mostly 2 days during a cold month in rural New England. Dr. Hunsinger's ailing husband, Christopher, has wandered off into the woods, and the desperate scientist struggles to hold her life together during the ensuing search initiated by the county rescue squad and fire department. A lead member of the rescue team pairs up with her in this quest, but he has problems, mainly marital, of his own, and can barely hold his own head high. How a person acts under stress is the key to the soul, is how Jeff, this rescue squad guy, sees it. Neither he nor Susan Hunsinger seems to be doing a terribly good job at this until they work together. Meanwhile, there's a wild card character, a troubled boy named Corey, who in his own disturbed and self-punishing logic may hold the key to all. All of this goes by with good momentum, since you can read this novel, or at least I read it, at freight train speed, taking in one scene quickly and rushing on to the next, happy, in the end, that a novel so replete with misery can turn out to deliver so much reading pleasure.
The book is Lost by Alice Lichtenstein. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University.